Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This campaign has taken away his Twitter. In the last 2 days, they had so little confidence in his self-control, they said, we're just going to take away your Twitter. Now, if somebody can't handle a Twitter account, they can't handle the nuclear codes.
Welcome to Politics, a psychological experiment conducted by the CIA using the remaining scientists involved in MKUltra. I'm a brainwashed comedian from New Zealand named Tim Batt, and joining me, as always, is a professor with no ethics drafted by the US government to torture people, Dr. Jeb Lund, not a real doctor. Hello, Jeb.
Welcome.
You remember MKUltra? It's back, baby, in election form.
I do. You know, I was so upset. I was reading an article just a couple months ago about how apparently it's really hard to get good acid in America. So anymore, just because it, I guess the manufacturers died out or it's become more difficult. And I'm glad to know that Uncle Sam is bringing that back to, hopefully, reboot our remote viewing experiments, especially since COINTELPRO is already just, kicking it. We've got 15,000 agents apparently with no brief running around the country.
Apparently, if I remember rightly, there's I've forgotten his name, but there's a guy who's kind of known as the father of LSD who did die kind of recently, in the last 5 years maybe.
Yeah.
And he at one point was producing 90% of the entire American supply of acid. And to that man, I tip my hat, I pour out a tiny bit of my 40-ounce, and onward with the electoral experiment. It feels like weaponized acid, actually, the kind of media environment we're in. What's it like being in America mere hours away from the final election day, Jeb? What's the mood? What's the tenor?
I feel like a lot of people are tense because it's what they feel like they ought to do. And in the same way that you get that kind of mass hysteria of, you have an event, that everybody's supposed to feel adulation or anxiety about. And so you see people checking in on Facebook with greater and greater extremities of excitement or discomfort because it's just sort of assumed that this is what we do today. And So I've seen a lot of people going I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm going to just be on pins and needles. Maybe I should drink, but I don't know how I'll cope with the aftermath if I'm not, don't have a clear head. And I don't know, as somebody who will sit in the same position for an entire game if my baseball team scores a run, because I think that staying in that position will help them to score more runs, I really should not be making fun of people for being superstitious. But, what are you going to do? It's going to be over soon. Take a nap. I don't know, have a...
Fuck, I love this attitude coming from you, Dr. Lund. That is great. Hydrate. Relax, eat well.
Take some reds.
Your position is not going to change the outcome of this election, which I hasten to add, judging by historically large early voting numbers, is kind of already done.
Well, okay, so that's one of those things where I want to be excited about it, and we can kind of talk about that later, because I know you mentioned something along those lines, but... I want to get excited about it, but early voting numbers have been going up just sort of across the board. So when you see all these people coming out for early voting, I think a mistake that a lot of people are making is they're saying, okay, we've got X 100,000 people in this county who have early voted. Well, that just means that, when you kind of crunch what we would expect on the day of, it's going to be through the roof. And
I don't know if you can hear that, but there's fireworks happening in my backyard right now. I apologize for that. The reason is, in New Zealand, we celebrate Guy Fawkes, which is our version of 4th of July.
Yeah.
Which, just a very brief history lesson for those who don't know, Guy Fawkes was a man in the 17th century, I think, who tried to blow up Parliament in England. And we celebrate this attempted terrorist plot by blowing up a small piece of our backyard annually. So apologies for that noise, Jeb, as you were.
And because you're all fanatical Catholics, right? That's
only half of us.
No, but it's just sort of, you know, the kind of like counting the chickens before they hatch thing. I'm going to be interested to see if there is sort of a ceiling to these numbers, and what you're going to see is like there was a ton of early voting because it's just more convenient and people have gotten used to it over time. And yeah. Then we won't see nearly the sort of explosive numbers on the day. So, you know, I'm anxious about that, but like I said, I'm not going to do anything about it.
So do you see this more of a refinement of the entire election process that happens over time, and that people are getting more used to the fact that because you idiots hold your general election on a Tuesday, which your average typical American has to, I don't know, work or get the kids or something, that they're sorting out their lives to be able to do it in the weekends when available and that sort of thing, rather than some sort of one-off rush to the polls in response of the Trump threat?
Yeah, that's part of it. One, two, you know, I think a lot of people, you know, even sort of affluent people who could get off from work to do it in the middle of a Tuesday, have been affected by, let's say, if you're the Republican Party and you want to start shuffling around where voting machines are or reduce them in certain precincts so that the lines are longer and discourage voting. Well, that'll bind up people who aren't just black. So I think just the ease and opportunity of it has become more normal. I know after 2000, there was such a paranoia about getting your vote counted that Move On and a lot of Democratic outreach groups encouraged a lot of absentee balloting, because that way you had a paper trail. Because in 2004, there was a great deal of paranoia about how easy it was to hack Diebold machines. I think I think somebody hacked it, and I'm quoting from an old Harper's issue from 2004, but it was, I think, like 32 seconds was all it took to remove the data card and replace it with another. So that
conversation, by the way, is still very much out there in the deep, dark recesses of the internet where I hang out. Parahemplay, the Donald subreddit. I'm sure that's going to be, those Diebold machines are going to be a point of lively discussion in the next few days.
Yeah, of course, like the reason why everybody was paranoid about them and wanted to use absentee ballots in 2004 for the paper trail was that, you know, the contractor, the company that made Diebold, had far more ties to conservatism than to the left. So it was thought, well, you know, if this is going to be an easily co-optable machine, it would probably be done via the manufacturer who would be eager to assist George W. Bush. So, you know, just goes to show like how malleable the actual evidence for these conspiracy theories is.
It's a big old shrug emoji from me. The right claimed it, the left claimed it. I don't fucking know, man. I don't know.
Well, look,
it's kind of, from a technical standpoint, though, it is kind of interesting. There are a couple of good articles. I think Ars Technica, they tend to cover this around election time. I assume they've got a good article about getting into the specifics of how easy it is to hack those voting machines. But we are not experts in that, nor am I an expert in anything in particular, Jeb.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, like, we're getting a little in the weeds. And before we did that and started to focus on the negative stuff too much, I wanted to ask you a question sort of performatively. I'm asking for our viewers who are seeing with their ears, who are really, they've got the whole daredevil thing. They're picturing you, you know, surrounded by angry, exploding Catholics in New Zealand. And they're wondering.
I am known as New Zealand's Ben Affleck, by the way. So that metaphor is apt.
So, you know, and I think they're probably wondering, you know, Why does this matter so much to you? I mean, you're on the other side of the world, almost literally.
True.
You know, you don't have to answer to any of these people. Your healthcare is free. You know, they filmed The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings there. You know, it's not like you're going to want to take off and move to Ames, Iowa. So, you know,
and boy, do we never get sick of being reminded about that movie franchise.
Look, I don't know anything else that was filmed in New Zealand. I assume there was a really good documentary about Captain Cook, but...
Nope, not that I'm aware of anyway.
Well, it probably didn't make it there.
to remove the snark and attempt to answer your question earnestly. I don't know if there's a particularly sexy or interesting answer to this, but here's what's happened, Jeb. Number one, in New Zealand, our news media sucks massively. It's been kind of falling apart at the seams over time due to, I guess, market forces is what you would call it. We're such a small country, we've really only got two major TV networks that are free to air. And there's one called MediaWorks here, which controls TV3, which was sort of like... It's one of the two big 6 o'clock news channels that everyone watches at night. And they also own a large portion of the TV, the vast majority of the TV comedy scene here in New Zealand. And I'm constantly talking shit about them on Twitter and destroying any chance I will ever have of being a TV comedian here in New Zealand.
That's good, but, man. Don't sell out.
Well, that's where I'm coming from. I'll keep my integrity and mountains of credit card debt. Thank you very much.
So I've got what you're saying is you're going to relocate to LA and you need to know who's going to be the overlord here because, that shit is played over there.
Yeah, as a result of the media environment here being so like shit, I've actually found myself over time really disengaging with New Zealand politics and New Zealand current events, which is not a good thing. You shouldn't do that. But what I've been attracted to, like a big blinking LED light with cool sounds attached to it and some animated sign, is the American political scene, because it's so loud and animated and it's not always super crazy. Like oftentimes, because I've sort of been following national US politics for a few years now, there genuinely is... There is a bunch of smart people who are articulating different ideas from different parts of the political spectrum, and you've got all these states who swing different ways. You mentioned last time talking about the states being laboratories of democracy and different ideas that get tested out. And it's like, it's cool. America is this big crazy experiment that's going on kind of philosophically and politically, and it's fun to watch that happen. And I know a lot of people in America wouldn't agree with this, but you do have a really cool media environment if you know how to navigate it properly, I think. So like, you've got to kind of spend more time consuming a little bit from everywhere to get this middle point. But if you do, I do think there's more good stuff happening over in the States. That's kind of the first initial thing to do with my short attention span. And then the more important kind of serious answer is that I don't know if Americans have a great appreciation of this unless they travel a bit, but for New Zealand and a lot of countries in the West, so we're talking like Australia, Canada, the United Kingdom, American foreign policy in particular really sets the hegemony for the rest of the world, and we all follow you. And New Zealand follows very closely. If Barack Obama says jump, our Prime Minister John Key says how high immediately. There's no question of American authority or even American policy direction under our current government. We had a previous Prime Minister, Helen Clark, who was recently in the running to become the first female head of the UN, I think. Who looks like she's not going to get that role now, but that's by the by. But she was a little bit more rebellious against the US, and that was kind of a hangover from a previous centre-left government led by the late David Lange, who was the one who made it a real centrepiece of his political career and campaigning to disallow nuclear ships from coming to New Zealand because we don't have atomic power here. And so over time, we've drifted closer and closer towards America. That's why I like to pay attention to it on the kind of national scale to find out what ideology is going to be guiding us and the rest of these smaller countries that follow the states and are left in their political wake.
I wondered if it might be that. The other kind of enlightened self-interest reason I thought might be that, it seems like we tend to export... like if there's a bad idea in American conservatism, you guys will get it, 5 years later or 10 years later, something like, that.
Yeah, I think there's aspects of that for sure. We get everything, like we get the diet version of everything America puts out on every end of the political spectrum. It feels like you guys have just got a stronger... It's interesting because you're definitely positioned, your entire political spectrum is positioned more to the right of New Zealand, and I think of most countries, not by heaps, but by enough.
Most countries that don't have leaders that wear epaulettes, yeah.
Yeah, but then again, you've still got these significant figures that pop up like Bernie Sanders, who it would be untenable in New Zealand. You wouldn't get anywhere being a 70-year-old minch who's just rolling around talking about socialism outwardly. So it's kind of everyone has the potential to get their little piece in the spotlight as long as they're loud enough in America. And I kind of like that about that country, about your country.
No, like there's always that impasse in the conversation where somebody's like, "Well, I kind of enjoy this about your country," and you're like, "Well, okay." I mean, it's sort of like when you take,
I think
it's like when you take somebody to Taco Bell who's never been to Taco Bell, and they're like, "Wow."
That's probably a fair analogy because there's a good deal of novelty that's inherent in my love of it. Because, you know, obviously, I get pretty insulated from the direct fallout of it. You know, the immediate consequences of these big figures on both sides of the spectrum.
Like the,
it's kind of like the dying of a big thought experiment.
I was gonna say like the whole like dying of preventable illness thing.
How so? Explain that to me a little bit.
Oh, I mean, you guys have national health, right? National health service. Yeah. See, there you go. I mean, you know, I live in Florida, and our governor said, free money for the Obamacare, you know, for the Medicare expansion. No thanks. So there's.
I love the language around those sorts of debates in America as well, like the free money thing. And I know that you were using that to kind of ape the conservative talking points on the issue. But it's like, if you look at the economics of a single payer nationalized healthcare system, holy fuck, does it save a lot of money for the whole country?
Oh, absolutely.
But that's a conversation for another set of people for another day, for another podcast, probably.
Yeah, no, it's and I was going to say, like, the other thing that you're spared in New Zealand, so, like, one of my favorite things to do is when I go to the doctor and they ask what I do, and I say that I'm a journalist, and then they just will not let me go until I admit to what kind. Then when they find out I'm a political journalist, the people who are taking care of me and who give me medicine and treatment will then harangue me about socialized medicine for... as long as they have, like, for as long as their recall of various email forwards will hold out. And then
which direction do they harangue you, like, politically speaking?
Oh, very much to the right. And okay. Like, I can't fault them because in many cases, these are people who went into massive debt to become a doctor. So
sure.
You know, they're not going to get the immediate benefit of a socialized system because they're not the doctors who were trained under it and who had a subsidized education. On the other hand, you know, they had to be pretty good at math to dispense prescriptions and understand that. And so when you point out that before Obamacare, the United States spent more as a percentage of GDP than any other OECD nation on healthcare, and we still had 50 million people uninsured, you know, they somehow balk at, like, your mentioning that as maybe an indication that the system was fucked. And so we, like, yeah. And so I can't argue with them because, like, in some cases, you know, these are the people who dispense the Vicodin. I have an old injury. So, like, never pick a fight with your long-term pain management doctor. But if you can, please make sure that he's not a libertarian.
Yeah. So make sure that your doctor isn't Ron Paul and you'll be fine.
Yeah.
Thus concludes the first third of this episode of Politics. And I hasten to add as well, because we didn't set this out at the start, Jeb, it is the middle of the fucking night for you. And this is, we are on election eve as we record this.
Yeah, it's 2:51 a.m. And I gotta, like, as soon as we're done with this, I gotta try and finish. I have one piece coming out tomorrow and then ideally another one. And somewhere I gotta sleep for 4 hours and then try and hit a bunch of precincts. So...
Cool boy. Well, Jeb's going to go to sleep for precisely 20 seconds, and we'll be back with the second third of this episode of Politics.
But we are somewhat different personalities. Look at this mask. Look at this mask. Oh, wow. Look at that. Looks just like me. Nice set of hair, I'll say. Is there any place more fun to be than a Trump rally.
Welcome back to Politics, a pre-recorded internet radio show that pits two unlikely foes against each other from opposite sides of the world while two political foes fight for their lives from opposite ends of the spectrum. I'm Tim Batt, he's Jeb Lund.
Yowza. Hello,
Jeb, I want to play a word. Yowza, okay. It is the middle of the night for you, huh, buddy?
No, that was good.
I'm not going to let that slip by the radar.
Was that ad-libbed or, like, I didn't know we were doing material, like...
No, I wrote that one.
Okay. Right.
But I wrote it in a hurry and like moments ago. We don't need to dwell on how I come up with my material.
That's fine.
What I do want to do, Jeb, is I have assembled a list of all of the names of the Republican and Democratic candidates who we may have forgotten through the course of the last few months. It wasn't always Clinton versus Trump. And what I would love to do is throw some names at you and we'll play a word association game where you can tell me what feeling is elicited by this memory, this ghost of the political past coming back into the front of your brain.
Okay.
Does that sound right to you?
Yeah. Am I allowed more than one word? Like, not whole sentences?
Absolutely.
Just, okay. All right.
Yeah. I'm not going to put a parameter like one syllable or anything on you. You speak from the heart, but keep it brief because there are so many people here. Okay. The 17 original candidates who were running to be the Republican candidate this year were George Pataki.
Abortion.
He was going to kick off with one word.
He was the abortion. He was the only pro-choice Republican candidate, so I don't know why he ran.
Lindsey Graham.
Gay.
Like, or as you say, Lindsey Graham. Yeah, he's not gay. Just to put that on the record, effeminate would certainly be a word that I would use.
I think there are a lot of terms that we could dig out of 70s sitcoms for him, like confirmed bachelor, or you know, like man about town. Or my favorite euphemism for him is again, and like I'm cribbing from Charlie Pierce of Esquire, Huckleberry J. Butch me up.
Jesus, that's a reference lost on me. Wait, Lindsey Graham, he's married though, right? Isn't he?
No, I think he's like a lifelong bachelor, if I remember correctly.
Oh, far out.
Yeah.
And not to say that there aren't gay guys out there with wives. We've all read a newspaper.
It's a, you know, it's a spectrum, and you know, enjoy it.
Certainly is. Bobby Jindal.
Kenneth the Page. From 30 Rock. Like,
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's pretty good. Nice. Scott Walker.
Bald spot.
Where?
On the crown of his head. He's got male pattern baldness, and he claims that he is not actually balding. It just doesn't grow there anymore ever since he struck the underside of an open cabinet door with his head.
That is such an elaborate and specific excuse for male pattern baldness. Why wouldn't you just say you're losing your hair?
Well, I mean, and this is probably unfair of me to say, although I feel like anybody who wants to dispute it, I can give them ample links to prove this point. He's a massive idiot.
Okay. Speaking of, Rick Perry.
Rick. It's like, I don't know why. I was like, that can't be right. And like, it's Matthew Perry. No.
I don't think he ran for the Republicans.
No, I meant like the Commodore. Glasses.
That's your one word for Rick Perry.
That's the one thing he brought to this election that was different from 2012. He started wearing glasses.
That's true. Did anyone ask him what the departments of government were this time? Because that was his big fall from grace last time, right? That he wanted to get rid of all of them and then couldn't name them.
Yeah, he had three and he blanked on the third, and then he turned to someone on the stage, I think it was Ron Paul, and said, like, you know,
that's right.
And then, you know, Ron Paul threw it out there, and then that was a gaffe. But, like, honestly, you know, everybody brain farts on something. It's, you know, it wouldn't have been persuasive of anything if Rick Perry hadn't already been kind of a dunce in multiple other respects. But yeah, he brought out the glasses, and then, I don't know, if somebody asked him, it didn't really stick long.
Yeah, he flamed out pretty early. I was actually thinking about that 2012 moment he had on the debate stage recently with the context of Trump. And you're right, that moment by itself, we all, you know, have moments of brain farts, whatever you want to call it. But it's how you deal with them when you are supposed to be a professional communicator, which is how I would describe people who are vying for national political office in the States. Like, more than anything else, you are a communicator. And if I remember the moment quite clearly, in that he was just real embarrassed and apologized at the time a few times in a row. And Trump wouldn't do that. He would find some way to just sidestep onto something or call the debate moderator a liar for no reason in particular, or be able to pivot to something immediately. And it was like, intelligence isn't the thing that will get you through the gauntlet. It's communication ability. Anywho.
Well, that and the perception of whether you're winning or not, right? So when Perry has that gaffe in 2012, he's not, you know, unless I'm much mistaken, he was nowhere close to the head of the pack. But if you had, you know, if you had like a Reagan type who was, you know, at the top or at least, you know, closing on the leader in the polls, and he has that brain fart moment and he can just turn confidently and say, help me out here. I'm having a, you know, I'm just having a quick brain fart about the name. You all know I know the department, but no, you remember my stump speech, hit me with it. And then if the guy doesn't comply, listen, we have to be adversaries here. I understand he's protecting his turf, but yeah, as for the other two, and just go into it. And like, if you're, you know, winning is such a disinfectant for everything. So if you're ahead and you do that, it shows that you're confident in it and at ease. And if you're behind, it shows how bumbling and flailing you are. And, you know, it's one of the stupid things about kind of horse race journalism, where we will start to make excuses for people who don't need them. And then people who desperately need the excuses will say, like, you'll just have to do better. Like, everybody wants to, you know, to basically forgive the prom king and, you know, all the Striver nerds who have actually commanded the material and are going to, you know, work 10 times as hard for our affections. We just kind of chuck them out.
Man, that's pretty insightful. And I like that people listening will just project their own candidate into what you were just saying and political situation. It was good. I just flashing up with Trump, that kind of self-actualizing winner who read The Secret and really fucking ran with it. Trump is what happens when the Secret gets on steroids. You just believe something with your whole heart. Next name on my list is Rick Santorum.
Just the definition of his last name. I mean, like, there's really nothing I can think of. Although...
Yes, Savage really fucked him on that one, huh?
Yeah. The other one would maybe be Blah People. I don't know if you remember in 2012 when he said, you know, I don't want to take your tax dollars and give it to black people. And then everyone went, holy shit. And then he said, no, I meant Blah People, because it's a term that everyone uses.
Yeah, he claimed that he got halfway through the word, then didn't know what the second half of the sentence was, and said blah. Yeah, the recording's out there. You can hear him say black people.
Yeah.
It's no good.
He is although, a blah person.
To Rick Santorum's credit, I'm not sure why I'm rushing to this man's defense considering the two things we've said about him so far, but I did hear him, I think it was this year, apologize for his comments, which earned him the definition from Dan Savage, which I believe, so Rick Santorum, fundamentalist, Christian, and very conservative, prominent gay voice in America, Dan Savage, suggested that we redefine Santorum as being the mixture of
frothy
shit and semen. Yeah, that's right, frothy mix.
Frothy mixture of semen. It's the frothy mixture of lube and fecal matter that is often the byproduct of anal sex.
There you go. Really, yeah. Oh, actually, I know what it was. I think it was Rick Santorum was articulating that old classic argument that if we let the homos get married, next thing you know, dogs and men will be getting married.
Yeah, it would be,
it was a riff on that.
Yeah, man on dog. I think it was the exact
there
phrasing.
There you go.
Next it would be man on dog.
That's it. And he walked that back either this year or late last year. So, you know, I've always got an open heart for people who want to apologize and correct past behavior.
If we're going to rehabilitate Rick Santorum here, I just want to say, like, his book was one of the least abusive of the candidate books that I had to read this year. I read all of them, barring, I think, one from Kasich and Hillary Clinton's tomes. And he actually was closer than anyone to Trump on articulating anxiety about free trade. So he kind of, you know, in his book and on the stump, he came close to saying, well, you know, there's a problem here when we can't protect our native industry. And then he just, you know, he got to that critical moment and then turned all Republican and just said, but free trade is great. You know, and so, right. you know, just, well, I'm not going to erect tariff barriers. And you're like, dude, you almost kind of get the point of what your constituency might want to hear. And then he just never quite walked through the door. He opened it, he took a look, and he didn't go through. And it's too bad because, like, of all of them, you know, Ted Cruz is by far the most eloquent, naturally, but Santorum's very good. I mean, like,
he is.
There are times when I believe him when he's talking, and that's not easy to make happen with me, so.
How about Jim Gilmore?
Who? I mean, like, that's it. Who?
Yeah, I can't remember a thing about him except for his weird smiley face. And I hope I'm even thinking of the right guy, but he looked like a happy troll doll.
Yeah, but that could have been Lincoln Chafee as well.
That's true. He's coming. Yeah. Don't skip ahead, please, Jeb. Next on the list, Carly Fiorina.
Okay, so this is the thing I think of, and I'll be honest here, and I apologize. The thing I think every time I see Carly Fiorina, and I can't help it, is Bill Nighy.
The science guy?
No, Bill Nighy, like N-I-G-H-Y, the British actor.
Oh, right.
Who,
yeah,
has got the swept back Actually. Hair and the pursed lips. Yeah, Love Actually, and he's the old, like, vampire in Underworld, and you know, he's been in a bunch of those Richard Curtis movies, but they just have this uncanny similar resemblance, and I think it's just sort of the length and thinness of their heads, and they both have the same pursed lips. He's got this very peevish, pushed out lower lip expression, and that was Carly Fiorina's kind of resting expression. And I just thought, like, you know, they could get, you know, Bill Nighy to show up on SNL and drag, and it would be flawless, and everybody would applaud it. But if you just sort of mouth off about that on Twitter, it's like, how dare you? You know, you're just insulting a woman's, you know, it's like, I'm not insulting her appearance. And, you know, I happen to like Bill Nighy. I think he's a fantastic
and he's
actor.
A good looking dude.
He
is a good looking cat.
He's a handsome and imposing man, and, you know, but he has certain gentle features. You know, I think he would make an attractive drag. Not that, you know, like, that usually works for me, but it works with Bugs Bunny, but that's a completely different issue.
Carly Fiorina was someone who I really would have liked to have seen gotten further in the process, because she was, like I was talking about before, these strong personalities that come up in American politics, and she was like a real firebrand for a while there until she went absolutely fucking insane with the what is it called over there, the family those fake videos that she claimed were real of the people from the,
oh,
it's like family planning. What's your version of family planning called in America?
Planned Parenthood.
There you go. The Planned Parenthood video thing, where she really kind of went off the deep end there. And I think that's where she lost any semblance of mainstream support from the Republican base. But up until then, like, she did really well in one of the debates and then lost the lead a little bit. But she was fucking interesting. She was this person who had this mixed history from the private sector, which was amazing that she was the former CEO of HP, I think, but then kind of fucking tanked the company too. So it was like this really kind of loaded context to her, and she was weird, and she was strong, and she was a good talker, and she looked really fucking angular, I think is the word, like, very powerful.
Yeah,
it's kind of cool.
I think the sort of the analogy that a lot of women commentators I saw using was she had a very kind of Cruella de Vil vibe.
Yeah,
that sort of tall and imposing. But I mean, the thing, like, the couple of things that you cited, like, you know, the first one that was just going to kill her in any climate in which Donald Trump and that kind of protectionist thinking was, you know, the flavor of the cycle, right? She was never going to get over the fact that she, you know, didn't offshore, she right-shored, that was the term, something like 22,000 jobs.
What does right-shore mean?
It just means offshoring, but it's the, like, the business speak, because you're putting them on the right shore where you can, you know, pay people less or, and, you know, whatever.
I've never heard that term before.
There was,
it is some Orwellian language.
There was that, there was the fact that, like, you know, the previous, I think it was Lucent that she worked at before, or it was something, I'm drawing a blank. Both of those companies, she basically kind of, you know, she had a lot of She made poor decisions that yielded short-term gain, but long-term didn't build the company. You know, during her tenure at HP, Apple creates the iPod, the iPhone, and the iPad. What does HP do? They bought a printer company. so there was that, and then the fact that like all those forceful things that you were talking about, they were bullshit. Like, so I can still remember, it's like the first thing I would do is I'd rebuild the Sixth Fleet, then I would call my good friend Bibi Netanyahu, and you'd go through like all That's she had this right. speech, and like she had five items in it, and like I think four out of five were from a fucking fantasy land. So like the Sixth yeah. Fleet is largely administrative, right? So she's basically saying like, I will rebuild the naval accounting core, right? And then, I'll call my good friend Bibi Netanyahu. Well, no shit. Like literally every president can call Bibi Netanyahu. It doesn't matter. And then it's like, I would step up these joint training exercises in the Baltic. Well, Obama's already doing that. So I don't know what you're going to do.
What you got left, lady?
You're going to do them twice each day? And then there was another one that was one of those things like, I'm going to make sure we do this. And we're already fucking doing that. So she had these great canned responses that sounded really forceful, but there was no substance to them. And she didn't have that kind of like, that sort of oleaginous way of saying canned bullshit over and over again that makes people feel empathized at, the way that Marco Rubio could just sort of weep for America and the audience on command, even as he was saying the same shit over and over. There was something like the sexist term to use would be brittle, right? You know, and maybe that is entirely my reading it, because it was that personality coming from a woman. And if it had been a male candidate, you would just think, well, that's no nonsense. But the fact that she couldn't sort of deviate from that script and make it seem like it mattered, I guess, might have been what sunk her. Well, that and just, you know, like HP and her previous job and Trump clowning her. And you know, maybe it was just her time to fall and
There's a lot of reasons why she did. Yeah, there's a whole buffet of options that you could pick for why she did not go further. Let's get into lightning round. You know, I took my own bait in expounding on these names too much, so my apologies.
Okay, sure.
So we've still got like eight left. Mike Huckabee.
Large adult sons.
Chris Christie.
Big Chicken.
Rand Paul.
The professor's son, right? Like the kid who aces all his prelim courses in college because his dad has just been feeding him the information all his life. But you know, so he shows up and he gets straight A's for 2 years basically. And then as soon as he actually has to take something difficult and think on his own, he's a fucking shambles. That's him.
Spot on, man. Jeb Bush.
Oh, man. Pity?
Yeah. Ben Carson.
What's his last name? Dr. Bunsen from The Muppets.
Oh, Beaker? Is it?
No, Beaker's the one with the bright orange hair and the really thin guy. Dr. Bunsen's the one who has the big glasses and no eyes.
Oh, but wait, the bald one who's always in a lab coat?
Yeah, yeah. So he's you know, he's lighter green than Kermit, and he's got the glasses, but he doesn't. But he doesn't have
the. He's asleep all the time.
Exactly. There you go. And he's a doctor.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
My bad. That took longer than it should have for me. My apologies. Marco Rubio.
Fraud, charlatan, grifter, mountebank.
Yikes. John Kasich.
Face divots. You know, he's got
Ted Cruz.
He's got that pursed mouth, and it just sort of, you know, they folded in at the corners, or you just sort of like, you feel like you could stick a pencil in the lower corner of his mouth, and it just stay there.
He's like a Mad Magazine fold-in, but kind of pretty up. Ted Cruz.
Vampire.
Yeah. I would have also accepted Zodiac Killer and Donald Trump.
No, Zodiac Killer, like, this is the thing, I'm totally going to stick up for this. Like, me and my buddy Brocare used to have this running gag where we would just, like, accuse different members of the Obama administration of being the Zodiac Killer. And then finally, Jay Carney became the White House spokesperson, and he looks uncannily like the sketch of the Zodiac Killer. So we had this running gag, and then suddenly the Ted Cruz's Zodiac Killer thing starts from a guy who has a history of biting jokes. And it was like, fuck that. Like, you know, the age isn't right.
You will not accept.
Doesn't fucking look like him. Latecomers
or imposters to your Zodiac Killer gag.
Get your own fucking joke.
And true lightning round, I want to do it for the Democrats as well. Martin O'Malley, remember him?
The chest. The chest.
Lawrence Lasik.
Oh, tiny. He's got the glasses that look almost like pince. How do you pronounce it? Pince nez? Like pince nez? Whatever.
I don't know what they are.
The
Lincoln Chafee.
Lincoln Chafee, Daugherty professor.
Jim Webb.
Killed a guy.
Yes. Exactly where my brain went as well. That was fucking freaky. That moment doesn't get talked about enough in the dust cloud that's been created in the Clinton-Trump debates, but holy shit, that was a moment to behold. Bernie Sanders.
I think, yeah, you said it earlier, mensch. I think mensch is a perfect word for Bernie Sanders.
Hillary Clinton.
I don't know. Like, I just want to think of a slogan thing, like something sort of pre-processed, and all I'm thinking of is like trumped up trickle down, or when they go low, we go high.
See, the whole beauty of the word association game, Jeb, is it's supposed to get at your subconscious by not allowing these other thoughts to form in your brain. You're supposed to shoot from the hip and reveal your true character is a misogynist, racist, anti-Semite. That has been this entire goal of the podcast. It's all led up to this episode and this game.
Star Trek administrator. I mean, it's killing me.
Nice.
I made this joke back in the Democratic primary. She just looks like one of those guys from the Next Generation who just wears the big collared long tunic. And
yeah, that's good.
And then, like, it just sort of the personality wise too, because those people always have a problem that the Enterprise identifies and that they have a blind spot to, and they're usually well meaning. They're probably bound up in a little bureaucracy, but they just have these tunics and this sort of ritualized behavior within their own little governmental milieu. And so every time I see that, I just every time I see one of those outfits, I think like, any minute the away team is going to beam down and go, listen, we're going to have to help with your retail politics.
Yeah, she's a space bureaucrat is what you were describing.
Yeah.
That's not bad.
Yeah.
And I've got three bonus names for you, Jeb. So listen up, because the first one is Vermin Supreme.
Galosh. He wears it on his head.
Nice. Jill Stein.
Vaccines or chiropractor, mm-hmm. Right? She's Dr. Jill Stein, but she cracks your bones. I mean,
wait a fucking minute. Jill Stein is a chiropractor?
Isn't she? I can't remember.
No, I think she's a medical doctor.
Is she really?
We must fight because this, yeah. I we got to check this because the reason why that's such a big deal, for me, Jeb, and I'm sorry, my brain's trying to do two things at once as I desperately Wikipedia here. While talking to you, my girlfriend is a real doctor, a general practitioner, and she's got a real bugbear about chiropractors rolling around calling themselves doctors. So that's a big flag. She is a medical doctor.
Yeah, she's an MD. Yeah.
Okay. Would you like to correct your answer, or should we just move on to the final name?
Oh, just the vaccine thing. Like that'd be the that's still the first thing that comes to mind. Like I'm going to flirt with this fringe just because it's going to buy me some extra attention on and like, I know that the people have like, somebody parsed her language and it was taken out of context or whatever. And I honestly just don't give a shit. I mean, like that's like the most defining aspect of her campaign, apart from the fact that, as a substitute for actually having a plan, she just offered the Green Party to Bernie Sanders.
And even flirting with that whole anti-vax thing as a medical doctor, like, fuck you. I don't care what the language is. That's That is total bullshit. And last, and in some ways very much least, Gary Johnson.
Burka Band.
I didn't know about that.
He back in 2015, he was still advocating for a burqa ban, and for the same reason that the French do, ease of identification and reducing, you know, potential terror attacks or whatever. And it was just like, and I wrote a column for The Guardian, and I don't remember what the title was, but it might as well have been like, how do you fuck up being a libertarian this bad?
Yeah, that is an incredible game of mental gymnastics that you are pulling, being the head of the Libertarian Party and advocating that kind of policy. That's what a brain to exist in for a day, eh?
The mysteries
it must contain.
He later repudiated it, but I think it was basically kind of people going, what the fuck, dude? I mean, this is like one of those no-brainers, sort of like if you're a medical doctor and people ask you if the anti-vaccine movement has any legitimacy, you go, no, fuck off.
Thus concludes the fantastic rapid fire game. Thank you for playing, Jeb.
We're going to take
a quick break, and we're going to come back and talk about actual newsy shit that's happening on this, the eve of the US presidential election.
No, it is the presidential. We're already there.
Oh, you're right. It's 2 a.m. Damn.
Yeah. All right.
Several days before FBI Director James Comey sent his letter to Congress last Friday about this matter. In fact, Mr. Giuliani went even further and bragged about the information he had obtained, stating, quote, did I hear about it? You're darn right, I heard about it. So they're saying that you confirmed this morning you got this leaked information before the FBI wrote to Congress about the new review he wanted to undertake.
That's not correct. I've had no conversations with anyone inside the FBI.
Welcome back to Politics, and I would just like to ask that we all take a moment and bow our heads in prayer for the future of this country, and just think about the words, dear Lord, protect this rocket house and all those who dwell within the rocket house. Okay, that's good.
Amen.
Let's go. Break.
Okay, so the thing that's on my brain at the moment, Jeb, that I want to ask you about as a political journalist is the FBI. Because James Comey, the director of the FBI, has come out in the last few days, and we haven't spoken for a long time, he's come out in the last few days and said that upon analyzing the 850,000 emails which they obtained through Huma Abedin on a device that she shared with her husband, disgraced former New York Senator
Carlos Danger.
I was trying to remember his alias. There you go. Senor Danger. So anyway, look, they got this big trove of emails. They've been through them, and the final word from Comey was that it did not change their conclusion that he put forward in July, I think it was, that Hillary Clinton was not going to be charged with anything. So in amongst this, in the backdrop as well, Rudy Giuliani suggested that he had advanced word that this announcement was going to be made 2 days before James Comey came out and said that they had obtained this additional supposed relevant piece of information that could be pertinent to the Clinton case. And as a result, people started talking about maybe an investigation going into Rudy Giuliani and how he got this information out of the FBI. He then was talking to Wolf Blitzer in the last couple of days and walked that back and stated that he had no inside information. Although you got to say, like, he pretty heavily suggested that he had a contact in the FBI that, or someone who used to work for the FBI, at least, who was feeding this information to him. So all of this to say, my question, Jeb, is what happens? What is the relationship between presumed President Hillary Clinton and the FBI going forward from here?
God, that's a million-dollar question, because, you know, the obvious thing you would do is fire James Comey, or, you know, they have a fixed tenured term, but I know that there has to be a mechanism for removing him. I don't remember what it is at the moment. I'm going to blame it.
Him quitting?
3:21 in the morning. And then, you know, you could go through and clean house, because apparently in, you know, one of the New York regional offices, there is this sort of cadre of guys who are digesting Breitbart.com and seem to believe it wholeheartedly and have been agitating and pushing against Comey to you know, reopen investigation against Clinton. You know, I guess because they're just true believers, and it's not surprising. I mean, the FBI is overwhelmingly middle-aged white men.
Yeah.
And so, you know, like that would be the obvious tack, right? But the, you know, if the first thing she does is make heads roll there, it's going to look like, well, you know, the liberals are cleaning house and throwing, getting rid of like any accountability mechanism that actually questioned them. This is, you know,
and
this,
it's just,
this is an updated the Clinton kill list, only with jobs as opposed to lives.
Totally. And it's just something so opposite to how Hillary Clinton operates. She, I don't think, even if she got rid of James Comey, it wouldn't be in a fashion where there was a big public firing. It would be some backroom deal where he probably got a golden handshake and maybe some ambassadorship later down the track to a very nice island nation, some, maybe New Zealand. We're pretty peachy here. In exchange for quietly stepping down in the interests of just moving the whole country forward. But I suspect he's probably going to stick around, and Obama's White House has actually been issuing statements saying that they kind of have full confidence and faith in the FBI and James Comey as a director. And I can't imagine that there's a situation where the Clintons aren't still communicating back and forth a little bit with the White House, and that's some sort of coordinated message. So I reckon he's probably going to stick around, right? And they're just going to try and figure it out. And I think probably the way that Hillary Clinton interprets the situation going forward, this is how I would do it if I was in her shoes, is that she's probably got a lot of political capital with the director now. He kind of owes her. He's sort of fucked up. And it might be more useful to keep him round and have him in this state of kind of being on the back foot and a bit contrite about how the situation unfolded. He might be a more useful utility to keep around that way.
Yeah, no, that's a good read, and especially if you can get him to clean house on his own accord. If you, you know, you've threatened him with, well, we're going to get one of our we're going to get one of our friends on a Senate committee to start an investigation of you.
Mm.
If you don't kind of you know, if you don't take care of this sort of rogue element, because there would be a lot of ways to make it very, you know, easily palatable to the public. If you folded into, like, listen, if, you know, if we've got all these guys who are reading nothing but Breitbart, well, doesn't Black Lives Matter actually have something to fear from the FBI? Do we see, a reinstatement of COINTELPRO? Because again, like, there was this report that came out with this week that, you know, there are these, you know, 15,000 agents around the country that, like, in many cases don't have a directed brief for what to pursue. They're just sort of going to find things and infiltrate things and encourage, you know, sort of like what we've seen over the past couple of years with these foiled terror plots, where it turns out that all the sophisticated weaponry and planning that these terrorists came up with was given to them by their FBI handler, who just found some moron and kept encouraging him and going like, oh, wouldn't it be great if you had this, you know?
I've worked in an office environment. I've worked in a hierarchical business structure. I like autonomy as much as the next man, but 15,000 of those dudes rocking around without a brief, that is too many for me. That makes me very uncomfortable.
Maybe, like, it's late. Maybe it's 1,500. Please don't quote me on it. But it's still, like, you know.
Quote yourself, man. You're on a podcast.
Yeah. A friend of mine had a really good statement yesterday, like, you know, we'd be much better off if all police were replaced with civil servants, you know, because most of the, you know, most of that job could be done by civil servants. And then I can't remember what he wanted to do, the FBI. But yeah, I mean, these guys essentially not having a very defined sense of what their job is. And, and in many cases, having the latitude to go and try to find, you know, a case or some sort of malfeasance that makes them look good, you know, it incentivizes, like, on one side, you can say that incentivizes being more enterprising. And on the other side, you know, you have these, you know, these cases, multiple ones over the last few years of these terrorists who are essentially engineered by the FBI looking for a terrorist. And that's exactly what you did see with COINTELPRO, where you had the FBI infiltrating student organizing groups and you know, agitating groups and saying, like, well, why don't you agitate harder so that we can have a bust?
Yeah.
And it will be telegenic, and it helps to delegitimize your movement.
There is no doubt in my mind that that's still going on today as well, can I just say. I like that you're talking about this in the past tense, but man, that shit surely is going on today. I'll bet that that was happening in Zuccotti Park, is that what it's called?
Zuccotti, yeah.
Zuccotti Park, and yeah, like the Occupy movement, I'm sure, was infiltrated by FBI. Black Lives Matter has probably been infiltrated by the FBI. They like to have their grubby little mitts in every pie, you know?
Oh, sure.
And it does go bad.
I mean, that's the most enervating thing about like all this outrage from the left about James Comey. It's like, he's sullying the name of the FBI. I mean,
oh, please.
That's like, I mean, you know, that's like handing out, you know, to quote Apocalypse Now, it's like handing out speeding tickets at the Indy 500. That's like complaining about an accidental death, you know, in a charnel house. Like, you know, this guy is really just updating a long and loathsome legacy of, you know, an organization that has been like a serial violator and of civil liberties and plunderer of life for, you know, 90 years.
Well, something tells me that President Hillary Clinton's going to do whatever she can to try and tighten the reins on, if not just Director Comey, probably his 15,000 agents who are rolling around the countryside with nothing to do but look for trouble as well. Hey, one thing that's kind of interesting, this isn't really related to anything, but it's just been super interesting to watch, is the international market's response to Trump going up in the last 10 days or so. So there's been a bit of business commentary in various blogs and magazines and websites that whenever Trump's numbers go up, the US dollar has very observedly had a correlation where the dollar goes down compared to everyone else, to the point where I met up with a friend of mine today. I just saw them walking down the street. They're about to come to the States, and they were trying to pick the perfect time to exchange their money from New Zealand dollars to US dollars, and she was going to go ahead and do it today because she knows that the results are out tomorrow. And there's been so much fear in the market with the uncertainty about the election that it has been like tanking the American economy a little bit. And it's just like, it's incredible to me that Hillary Clinton is seen as so, I don't know what the word is I'm looking for. Stable's kind of too nice, but like staid and boring and establishment. And Trump is such a like discernible maverick to the international markets that it's having a discernible effect that you can observe looking at these different exchange rates. It's like a really interesting physical manifestation of what the whole world's feeling.
Yeah, it's not an original observation, right? But you know, there's a kind of a line that I've seen a whole bunch over the last year or so, especially with Trump, right? Where it's like, wouldn't it be nice if we could have a conservative party that was friendly to, you know, friendly about creating stable markets and market opportunities at home and abroad, and otherwise left people alone to be who they are. And we do have one. It's called the Democratic Party. Like, we just don't have an alternative to that. You know, all that kind of good government stewardship and being favorable to market forces and sympathetic to Wall Street that the Democratic Party allegedly isn't, that stopped in the 90s.
Yeah.
The only reason why the stock market goes up usually when Republican candidates do better in presidential elections is they're going to be even friendlier. But if you look at the overall performance of the economy, if you match up, if you compare Democratic presidencies to Republican presidencies post-war, the economy as a whole, not just the market, has always performed better under Democrats. So like, they've got nothing to lose with her. With Trump, I mean, this is a guy who could, you know, just say like, listen, we're freezing all, you know, we're freezing all Chinese assets in the United States, and we're going to seize them, you know, and we're going to cancel each other's debt out.
I get the markets never react to risk well. Like, that's kind of fundamentally, that is a fundamental market principle. But in particular with Trump's case, like, he's had a pretty uncohesive foreign policy and economic policy. But the bits that have always stayed the same has been this very protectionist anti-international, anti-trade viewpoint that, like, is just so damaging to relations with the rest of the world. I think the thing I'm trying to articulate is it's super interesting to have one candidate who, economically speaking, the entire globe would not be looking forward to them getting in power.
Yeah, no, it's, I agree totally, and that's why it's fascinating that he's still going to walk away with, you know, like tens of millions of votes. Everywhere, apart from, you know, the like fucking Oswald Mosley with fetal alcohol syndrome, Brexiter knockoff fucking English neo-fascist shits, right? Apart from them and like the Geert Wilders types in the Netherlands and the Marine Le Pen, you know, slime trail, like everybody thinks this guy is extraordinarily dangerous and should be nowhere near the levers of power. And yet it's still going to be like, you know, 4 points.
yeah, exactly.
I mean, how can you have like near global unanimity that this man is a dangerous fuckhead?
Yeah.
Oh, it's incredibly depressing too.
There are real reasons for that though as well, like a combination of how mechanically your political system works with regard to elections, but also this thing that a large portion of people who will be voting for Trump have projected whatever their own beliefs are onto this object, which is just anti-establishment and anti the system. And I can totally understand that. I get where that's coming from, and I guess that is how you get someone who's viewed as a James Bond level supervillain by the rest of the world, but will still, as you say, get within sort of 4 or 5 points of winning the presidency from the voting public.
And on the ground, like on a one-on-one level, it's very affecting and it's hard to watch sometimes. So, you know, you talk to people and you say, well, why do you support Donald Trump? And they mention, well, he's an outsider, which, you know, okay. Like, I mean, this is at one point that may have meant something. You know, if you made a strong enough argument for it, it doesn't. You know, like this is a statement of there's no value added by that.
Yeah, it's a black hole.
Yeah,
it's just a black hole that you can project your own shit into. But like a black hole, it just gets sucked up, and you kind of don't have anything to show for it at the end.
Oh yeah, no, like, you know, the great example is all the Democrats in 2008 who were for Obama and did not support Clinton. They say, well, you know, he was untainted by Washington. Well, look, you know, in every other election, they're usually trying to elect somebody who is a career politician. And the Democrats make the point that, like, actually being a career politician is extraordinarily helpful because it gives you expertise in the job you actually want to have. And then when they got Obama, they go like, well, you know, he wasn't part of the system, so he had the courage to say no, you know, and then, you know, as soon as 2012 rolled around, it's like, well, Mitt Romney has never been president. And so now, you know, now we're back to expertise because Clinton has a shitload of expertise and we want to elect Clinton, right? And but like the stuff that hurts. So, you know, you talk to these people and they do the outsider thing and then they say, well, you know, he's such a great businessman. He'll just fix the economy. And it kind of goes back to that thing about Rick Perry versus Reagan. You know, if you think of Donald Trump as a success, as opposed to somebody who inherited a shitload of money, defrauded a lot of people, and then let interest do the work, and then is hiding what his real value is, because again, we still haven't seen his fucking taxes. Like, the guy might be worth $800 million as opposed to multiple billions. But, you know, if you believe that he's a success, then you rationalize immediately, like, oh, multiple bankruptcies. Well, that's just what a smart businessman would do. You know, not every investment's going to go the right way. So you got to get out. You got to minimize your risk. You know, if I were an investor, that's exactly what I would do. And, you know, like the same people that if Clinton had mismanaged her own funds in any way, you know, had wound up with back taxes on anything, they'd be like, well, that's just cheating. That's, you know, but Trump.
But it's also, it's like, I can kind of understand that argument of this is a guy who had a singular vision to go out and make as much money as possible that the legal system would allow. And within that system is things like legal, I don't know what the American equivalent is called, but legal liability companies where you're not directly attached to it. So it can fall over and you're not personally liable for the losses that it sustains. I get that. But it's a different fucking skill set. from doing public policy. Like, the two things are not the same. There's this, I think, through the course of politicians trying to, there's no other word for it, talk down to the public and rationalize how these big conceptual mathematic economic models work, trying to communicate that to them and liken it to terms that they'll understand, like balancing a household budget. They've conflated two things that are not related in an attempt to explain things to the public and how they would do things differently. And the problem is, then you get people like Trump who come along and people go, he's a great businessman, which we can debate whether that's true or not, but let's assume he is. That still doesn't make him qualified to be looking after the largest economy on earth. Like, they are two super duper different skill sets.
Yeah, like, you know, this is something I kept harping on in 2012 as well. You know, well, Mitt Romney, well, he, Bain Capital, look at its valuation and look at how much money he made with that. Like, well, dude, you know, you can't Bain Capital the United States. You can't take the United States and then, you know, basically fire a bunch of the workforce and then sell off, like, your actual assets to somebody else and then take the windfall from that, like from selling America's assets to like Ecuador.
Yeah, it doesn't work when you do it on a global
scale. Share the money with America. Yeah, like, you know, the same mechanisms at work at, you know, at like private equity firm and or whatever, you know, you're not going to be able to, you can't apply that, like, well, listen, we're going to fuck somebody here, but we're going to come out great. I'm like, no, you got to make sure you don't fuck anyone. That's the point.
That's the game. And one final point I want to make while we're talking about this, because I am aware that this episode's blown out a little bit, but Trump is super guilty of this. Clinton is a little bit guilty of this as well. When talking about the economy and political candidates on any level, anywhere in the world, always do this. They always think that they will have some massive effect on jobs, which I've never bought that they have that power. And Trump in this cycle, and again, Clinton did it a little bit, claims that he would be able to bring these jobs back from China and Mexico where they've been outsourced to. It's a fucking lie. Like, the president who's going to inherit the White House from here on in is going to have to deal with some trends in technology which include automation, self-learning, self-driving cars, and the internet continuing to take all of these retail and service industry jobs, which is like huge portions of the total workforce, like the majority. I think the most popular job in America is truck driver, and that's going to be taken away quite soon thanks to self-driving cars. And so the next president isn't going to be dealing with getting these factory jobs back into America, because they just aren't going to exist from here on in. They're going to be dealing with way different solutions and different problems. And that's why we're going to get a lot more conversations over time about like a universal living wage, claiming that you're going to be able to bring these jobs, these like t-shirt making factory jobs back from China or Mexico is just fucking stupid. And I really am looking forward to the day when the wider public kind of figures that out and stops buying it.
No. Well, it's quite a rant, wasn't it?
Well, it pisses me off. As someone who reads a lot of like technology news, and I'm just continually impressed by the strides that like Google are making and these artificial intelligence agencies and stuff, and how we can really weaponize it. And it's like the politicians, the way that they talk about it, are just so fucking out of touch. And what pisses me off the most is that they don't believe it. I know that it's disingenuous. These people are informed. They know what's going on in the world, and yet they sell this separate old world vision of what's happening at the moment to the public, and it's completely unrealistic. And I'm goddamn sick of it, Jeb.
Well, I mean, like, so part of it, though, like, when they say, well, I'm going to create, I mean, are you talking about just creating jobs, or are you talking about bringing back a certain number of jobs?
Bringing back jobs.
Okay.
Well, both. I mean, they claim both.
I mean, because creating jobs, I mean, that's a, like a whole different donkey. I mean, if you pass, like, you know, if you pass something that is going to reduce college debt, right, you're going to create jobs because you're going to give people more discretionary income. Discretionary income creates a virtuous cycle in the economy because people are going out buying goods. Somebody has to manufacture those goods. That creates a job somewhere. So, you know, there's that shit. And I think that's usually what Clinton is talking about. Now, there's certain jobs that they can bring back, like at least within NAFTA, where they've outsourced assembly, but still a huge portion of the car is manufactured in the United States. So you still have those labor costs built in. And then there are other mechanisms.
It's true, but the numbers, sorry to interrupt you, but the numbers that we're talking about in terms of factory workers associated with auto manufacture these days is fucking tiny. It's like a super tiny drop in the ocean.
Tiny drop in the ocean relative to what?
To the total labor force. So like if you're talking about the amount of people who are actually involved in manufacturing cars now in terms of human beings, it's like this is a tiny number. In terms of talking about policy direction, like it's so insignificant, and I don't have the numbers offhand, but it's so insignificant that I don't think it bears mentioning.
So this is where I'm going to talk out my ass, and like I'm probably going to get like completely clowned on Twitter about this later. So like I don't, you know, I've because it's just sort of been the consensus for so long, you know, I haven't read a lot on sort of the rationality, the economic alternative to free trade, because so I don't know what really the impacts of it necessarily would be if you suddenly, you know, I know to a certain extent what'll happen if you start erecting trade barriers, but the argument from free traders always comes down to like, all right, you know, you buy a pack of 12 tube socks and it's $6.99. Well, that's because it's made in China, et cetera, et cetera. You know, for this wage. You know, if you brought it back to the US, that would be $19.99 for those socks. And like, that sounds like a really, really great example. And that immediately makes me not believe it, because these good examples are always like, whenever you find an example that good, it's always bullshit, you know? So, you know, how much time is spent actually making those socks? Like how many man hours are you putting into making, you know, six pairs of tube socks that you can have this effect with, you know, the wage? And then how much, you know, how much expense are you putting in for shipping it from China to the US? Because that's a lot of petroleum. And then, you know, how are you off, you know, and then what about the, you know, what kind of impacts are we having on the environment that we're going to actually have to pay for by, you know, all the fossil fuel expenditure and the lower kind of, you know, carbon standards in China? And then the other question is, if you're paying somebody to make tube socks in America, sure, that's going to make the cost of tube socks go up. But if you're paying them a living wage, again, you get into the virtuous cycle of what they're putting back into the economy. Because if they, you know, what other jobs are they creating? So yeah, maybe you're starting with a pinch in, you know, tube socks, but what other viable, you know, what other viable occupations does it create? And like more to the point, like, you know, how much is the cost disparity in those tube socks amortized over the whole population, and how much can we absorb? And the reason why I think you don't see a lot of that kind of discussion enter the mainstream to the point where it sinks into like a lowly blogger's head like mine is that for as long as I can remember, it's been the Washington consensus that anything other than free trade is suicide. So there's never been an incentive to like really familiarize the public with, you know, viable economic counter arguments. And I hope that that's what Sanders has kicked off, so we can at least have a debate, you know, at all. Like,
and
because
Trump,
there's been zero
credit where it's due.
Yeah. Yeah. But there's been, you know, there's been one side, you know, it's been a conversation held in an empty room.
That is very big of you to admit that the country has been missing out on a debate, and maybe there's a small portion of your, how'd you describe it? Lowly blogger's brain that is missing some stuff by virtue of that conversation not existing, Jeb. I'm proud of you, buddy.
I'm missing a lot of stuff. Like, you know, I thought Jill Stein was a chiropractor like 30 minutes ago.
Well, we've all learned something today, and that's what it's all about. What a absurdly technical note to end on. as we enter literally the final hours of this election cycle. Jeb, it is entirely my fault that we have not been releasing these episodes as frequently as I initially intended, but it has been an absolute joy being with you for every step of the way. This, I don't think, will be the very last one, but we're getting close to the wire. So let me just thank you so much for your time. It has been a thrill. trying to keep up with that magnificent and informed brain of yours out loud over Skype, even at 3 a.m.
Yeah, it is a bit late. No, thank you so much. I'm so glad you suggested it. I would never have thought to like come bang on your door about it. So, you know, I'm glad that it occurred to you. It's been, you know, and I'm no longer terrified of podcasting the way I was before. Back in 2014, there was a podcasting accident. I don't really like to talk about it.
Oh my God. I don't know what I'll get this offline. Jeb, remind people where they can find you and find your work on the interwebs.
Tomorrow. So like probably after, you know, before this even comes out. So if you're listening to this, it's probably already there. I'll have a piece in Esquire. I should also have a piece in Deadspin. And then depending, I don't know if I'm going to be able to do it. I hope I can. I should be hosting Deadspin's, co-hosting Deadspin's Facebook Live coverage of the primetime election coverage. So from like 8 until 11 or so, it'll be, I think, Alex Perrine in New York, Tim Burke and I in Tampa Bay, a few other people around the globe affiliated with Deadspin. I don't know if there's going to be pranks or abuse or just people MST3King the coverage, but you should stop by. It should be fun. Hopefully we make the experience bearable.
And on an ongoing basis, if people are listening after that, where can they find you on Twitter and Facebook?
Oh, it's Twitter is Mobute, M-O-B-U-T-E, and Facebook is Jeb Lund's Word Salad. And what about you? Where can everyone get at you?
I'm on Twitter. That's where I live. Tim_Batt, B-A-T-T. And if you want to tune in to my podcast, which is the reason why Jeb knows about me in the first place, as I have mentioned earlier, me and my friend watch the same movie every week and keep reviewing it for a show called The Worst Idea of All Time. You're welcome to dip your toes in there or not. I won't begrudge you not tuning in for that show. Jeb, I'll talk to you soon. Stay safe. For the love of Christ, get some sleep. And let's all have a few beers tomorrow morning.
Righto.
For those who are still making up your minds or thinking maybe it's not worth voting at all, let me just say, the choice in this election could not be clearer. It really is between division or unity, between strong and steady leadership or a loose cannon.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.